It's Friday, the 15th of August. We have made it. Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel. It is very nice to have you aboard, and I thank you very much for being with us. You are welcome to join our conversation, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let me introduce our panel to you, and I'm very proud to do so. NYPIRG Legislative Director Blair Horner is with us, as is College of St. Rose Communications Professor Mary Alice Molgaard. Thank you both very much for being with us this morning.
And TGIF to you.
Yes.
Happy Friday. Happy Friday.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Again, we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We're going to start off once again with the story coming out of Ferguson, Missouri, over the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown, who was walking home from a convenience store on last Saturday, when he was shot. And this has ignited several days of protests that have been quashed by police officers shooting rubber bullets and tear gas at groups of demonstrators, and of course has come under a great deal of criticism from many different fronts. The authorities said on Friday that they would identify the Ferguson police officer who fatally shot an unarmed African-American teenager. This after days of calls for that announcement. And a lot has happened in the 24 hours since we discussed this topic. And what is, I guess, the big thing, of course, is the governor of the state stepped in and the state police took over the actual policing and security of Ferguson. So a lot of developments in this particular story.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the governor of Missouri stepped in and put the state highway patrol in charge of the policing of the event, of the events, you know, the various demonstration stuff, seems to have, at least for temporarily, diffused the situation. As far as I know from last night's reporting, things were relatively calm. And a sort of a marked demilitarization of the police presence. You know, you can understand, I mean, even when I'm watching it on television, it sort of, I can't even imagine what it would be like if you're out doing a peaceful demonstration and you're faced with people sitting on tops of big armored cars with machine guns pointing at you and tear gas being thrown around. I mean, that would make me angry. It makes me angry just to watch it. And while you can certainly understand, I mean, it wasn't like there was looting that happened. There was some violence that happened. You escalate. I think the policing strategies may have escalated the confrontations with its own citizenry, and it seems to have diffused it at least last night with a softer approach.
There is a line in the New York Times article this morning that says the difference in tactics and tone was apparent almost immediately. On Thursday night, the armored vehicles and police cars were gone. The atmosphere was celebratory. A street barricaded on previous nights was filled with slow-moving cars blasting their horns. There were few signs of police officers, let alone any forceful response.
And the demilitarization, I think that is the key term. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the week, that seeing these police officers in military-type garb, full body armor, and with the really high-caliber machine guns on these armored vehicles, that is very, very challenging and very intimidating for the public. And I think the scaling back of that has gone a long way to helping the situation.
And it's triggered a national debate over this. I mean, one of the pieces that I've saw about this is the sort of the growth of use of these sort of heavy Iraq War era, that's, you might as well call them tanks, but armored trucks and stuff that can somehow withstand the explosion from a landmine. They're all over the place now in the country.
And sure, they're here. That's right. There's one here in Albany County.
And people want to use their toys if they have them.
Right. Can we get a plow?
Be a little help more helpful.
A paver would
yeah,
be nice,
just
too.
throw that
well,
out.
Many of these armored vehicles became surplus, of course, as things wound down in the Middle East, and they were made available to local agencies. The one that is here in Albany County is one of those, and it's completely outfitted. It's painted black. It's a bit scary just to look at. I see it coming down down the street and getting out of the way.
Right. I mean, I assume there are listeners who think to themselves, well, you know, it'd be nice to have them when they need them. And there is, we certainly have to acknowledge that if there is, in an era where high-powered weapons are relatively freely available, even in states that have restrictive laws, it's not like the police don't need to have protections. But I think in the case, what was seen going on in Missouri is basically peaceful protesters were facing sort of a gauntlet of very well-armed, basically war-ready machinery and essentially soldiers. It sort of changes the climate of the situation.
And there's also there's the racial dynamic. So you look at the picture of a mostly white police force in all of this completely outfitted and ready for battle in this largely African-American community. And in mostly peaceful protests, and you think to yourself, wow, is that really necessary?
It looks like an occupying army.
I mean,
that's the kind of the scenes you would see in the Middle East or in Ukraine, you know, where there's actual conflict going on. These are the images that are being pumped out around the world. It's not even just like it's a local story.
Right.
It's become a story about modern day America. And when you have when you set it up where it looks like you're an occupying army, people behave differently than if it's their local sort of people that they know, that the police force represents their community, they're there to protect and serve. It's a completely different dynamic.
I'm also struck by the difference in tactic. And while you look at this and say, okay, this is such a difference from Wednesday night to Thursday night, and not the governor of the state, Jay Nixon, stepping in, And I know hindsight's 2020, but you do wonder why. Okay, maybe you should have done that sooner.
Why did it
you know,
take
I,
so long?
I, and I don't know. I don't know if that's a fair criticism or not.
Well, and I think another thing that is one of the factors here with the head of the Highway Patrol, the state police, is African American.
Yes,
and that probably also went a long way to helping diffuse the situation. He's from the region. He understands and knows the people there because of his own familiarity with the community.
Captain Ronald Johnson, who said we're starting a new partnership today, we're going to move forward today to put yesterday and the day before behind us. And we should note also that this came after the president spoke about it. He broke in at, I believe, noon yesterday and gave a statement from Martha's Vineyard, where he's on vacation, and said this is, you know, calling for calm and calling for a change in strategy. So you can only assume that the White House probably made a few phone calls in this regard.
I think that's a fair assumption.
Yes. Oh, by the way. Then, as I started off with the story, we are expected to hear the name, the officer to be identified. And given calm, you hope that remains. And I don't know exactly how that will change thing once this person is identified.
Well, it's become sort of the rallying cry of the protesters, is that they want to know who the individual is that did this. You can understand why the police force would be reticent to give the name out for fear of for the officer and his family who probably live in the area. I assume by now that they've sort of figured that stuff out. I think the public deserves to know it. To engage with the judicial process. I mean, America is a nation of laws, and so this process should roll forward. I think that will help diffuse the situation because you're taking away the rallying cry. There's a softer approach sort of on the policing side of it. But it's still, I still think it's sort of a tinderbox because the underlying reasons why why it spun out of control, the protests and the reaction spun out of control in the first place, is because of a series of issues with the policing in Missouri, actually, not just this community, that has sort of a racial tone to it.
It is when you look at the effort, and I think you mentioned this the other day, Blair, about that members of Anonymous were so I was going to say influential, but have been such a part of this, trying to get the name released, hacking into the government systems, taking to social media, doing whatever they can. And if anything, in this day and age, where so much information is available to so many people, it is surprising to me that nobody has printed a name. And that
well, that's a very good point.
It's really surprising.
And Anonymous did, as you said, identify a name, but apparently the incorrect name. And there's very serious danger in that, the wrong person being identified and subsequent actions that might have happened. But this is not a huge community.
No.
My guess is that the people in and around Ferguson probably have a pretty good idea who
the individual is. But I would think that then that would be out in 4 seconds.
But they're keeping it very close to the vest.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, though, Joe. I mean, the police force is, 50-some-odd individuals? It's not like the New York City police force with thousands of cops, right? But just the process of elimination. Some of them sit behind a desk. Some of them are not on patrols. You narrow down the universe of potential.
A guy told me at a bar it was this guy, and then suddenly it's national media.
And who have we not seen on the street for the last week?
Right.
You're right. I mean, it is sort of surprising. And maybe the fact that they have sort of zeroed in on who the individual is may be what's prompting the police to just put the name out today anyway.
And then there's this article also in the New York Times. When the people bring the hammer down, whether in Occupy Wall Street in Manhattan's in a Manhattan park in 2001 or outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968, the response from conservatives tend to be fairly consistent. The protesters got what they had coming. But demonstrations this week over the shooting of Michael Brown by a police officer in Ferguson and the overwhelming law enforcement response that followed have stirred more complicated reactions, with many on the right torn between an impulse to see order restored and concern about whether the crackdown is a symptom of a state-run amok. With broadcasts from Ferguson showing the streets engulfed in smoke as officers looked on wearing military fatigues and carrying high-powered rifles, some prominent conservative commentators and leading Republican politicians began questioning whether the police had gone too far. Even Rand Paul expressing concern about the crackdown.
A libertarian point of view, which is prominent among Republicans, is fear of the state. This really was visual images of what you would anticipate when you're reading the book 1984. I can completely understand why it would split the conservatives. And it really does stand in stark contrast to how the state, quote unquote, responded to these conservative or right wing militia type individuals protecting a farm out west. When the cattle, I can't remember the guy's name, the guy was running cattle on federal lands and not paying the fees he's supposed to pay, and then they kick him off, and that's became the rallying cry of conservatives. There you had people walking around with armed guns pointed at federal officials, and the state didn't step in the same way as they did in Ferguson. And so, there's sort of an interesting sort of split there as well.
Right.
Well, and sort of being the only one in the room who was in Chicago in 1968... the imagery is pretty similar. I was a teenager. I don't remember everything about that, but I do remember the tear gas, and I do remember the smoke bombs and things like that, and the police going in full battle garb with batons and shields and the heavy duty helmets. No machine guns, but it is quite similar in some respects.
And then you have two reporters who are. Held in custody for a brief time and then released when they realized sort of what had happened. They were in a McDonald's and roughed up a little and then, taken away.
Maybe it was a dietary issue.
Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe it was
trying to protect them
from
the
food. That's right. It was part of a Bloomberg policy. But then Ted Cruz comes out and says, reporters should never be detained. A free press is too important simply for doing their jobs. And you're like, wow, really? From Ted Cruz?
Right.
Cool.
Yeah, that was surprising.
How did that happen?
The interesting thing I was watching last night, they had clips on, Al Jazeera America had a film crew on site and they got tear gassed, and so they run away. And then the police come over again in full battle gear and sort of reset up the site by putting the lights down and pointing the camera toward the ground. And I was thinking about it when I was watching it. I could think to themselves, well, maybe they were concerned that these were really protesters with weapons. But that's hard to square it with the lights. And the police didn't make that argument. They made the argument that the lights were distracting them. But if that's the case, why would you tear gas them first?
Right.
And so it's sort of like the almost like just Chicago, where the police became out of control.
Right.
And, you know, there's the old saying, once you let loose the dogs of war, you have a hard time calling them back. I mean, I think that may have been what was happening here. The police force feeling under siege in a community that they're alienated from in the first place. By and large, they don't live there. That they react differently, and it really takes someone else coming in, someone with a sort of dispassionate view, to sort of calm things down. I mean, it's something really should be a lesson for the country.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will discuss many other issues. We welcome your input on this and those other issues. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after the short break. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. And it's wonderful to have you with us for this Friday morning. Roundtable at WAMC.org if you want to join in on the discussion. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. A couple letters that we got today, including this one from Nick, who says, the population of Ferguson is dominantly black, yet the elected government is reportedly mostly white, as is the police department. Why have the black residents not elected black representatives? Are they not putting up black candidates? Are they not voting? What is the dynamic that is causing non-representative government? Is this the residents' fault?
I don't even know the answer to that.
I don't either, although I do know that the congressional representatives and the state representatives are predominantly African American. The town council or whatever their form of government may be primarily white, but the at the state level, those who are in that particular region are people of color.
Which actually raises more questions than it answers, right? I mean, if you have one class of elected officials, state legislators being elected where African Americans, why not on the city council? I mean, it'd be an interesting question to see how the I don't know if the city council are at-large representatives who get elected or if they're in districts. Are the districts gerrymandered? Is this a campaign finance issue? I mean, there's a whole series of things. Or maybe they just vote on people based on who they think is best. But, I mean, the writer certainly raises a very good question. Now I'm going to have to go check it out.
And then there is this from Pete in Connecticut, who says, well, thanks for actually discussing these policing issues and the militarization of police departments throughout the nation. Now, I ask, where have you been for the last 5 years while those of us who have been paying attention have watched this with growing dread? Wake up and smell the totalitarianism. The police are no longer there to serve and protect the public. They're there to serve and protect the crumbling status quo, says Pete from Tolland. And those are our letters at the moment. We welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let's move on to other topics for the day, and we will go to a brief update in Iraq, which is the big story coming out that President Maliki said Thursday night that he had agreed to relinquish power, a move that came after days of crisis in which his deployment of extra security forces around the capital had raised worries of a military coup. His decision held out the prospect of a peaceful transition of power based on democratic elections and without the guiding hand of American military forces, which would be a first in modern Iraq's troubled history of kings, coups, and dictatorship. And it seemed to be in the coverage that I saw of this yesterday and watching NewsHour last night that this was not entirely expected, that he would. relinquish power.
It, when you're reading the article about the deploying the militias, his own the military around the what used to be called the Green Zone, certainly made people think something else was going to happen. I mean, it's sort of I think the Ayatollah Sistani, who is the leader of the Shia religious community in Iraq, the fact that he weighed in and the religious community weighed in saying that Maliki had to go, I think really sort of was the real pressure on Maliki, in addition to the United States. And whether or not they can actually cobble together a government that can respond to the crises created by the invasion by the group Islamic State is unclear. Usually governmental chaos helps your opponents, doesn't hurt them. Hope springs eternal on whether or not they can stitch something together.
I don't think they're going to get a unity government, which is the phrase being tossed about. But I think also when Iran decided to make their opinion known, I think it pushed him just a little bit further. Ideally, some people and critics are saying if they could divide the country into three, it would probably work a little better with the Kurds in the north and then the Shia and the Sunni groups in the rest of the country. But it doesn't seem as though at this point that that's going to be a viable option.
No, I mean, it's really awful. Islamic State basically runs half of Syria and half of Iraq right now. And why wouldn't they start to view it as their own country? It's going to be a source of unbelievable tension. It's going to be horrible because the Islamic State, organization is particularly ruthless, even beyond what al-Qaeda will stand for. And the people of northern Iraq are the people who are going to suffer, particularly the religious minorities.
And one of the things I noticed in commentary yesterday and then early this morning is that apparently the United States has been downplaying the situation in the minority area, the Azizis, right? And the United States has been saying, oh, it's not quite as bad. Everybody else in the world is saying, no, this is horrible. The conditions are terrible. The people are being slaughtered. And, where's the information that the United States is using? Where is that coming from? So there's a great deal of difference of opinion on the international front on that issue.
We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. And obviously, this is a story. It seems like it's just we're watching so much of the world in turmoil, and trying to follow it all is really, I don't want to, it's fascinating though. I mean, and we're at like a fascinating time where it seems like all of this is coming together at one time to work out and figure out.
Yeah, this is
almost like a reset button.
Yeah, it's this broad swath that starts really from the Ukraine and goes really all the way into Pakistan. Even today, there are apparently going to be street demonstrations in Pakistan calling for the newly elected prime minister to resign. And Pakistan has its own series of problems. I mean, you could probably keep going, I guess, but certainly that particular region of the world is, and northern Africa, it's a terrible time.
Let us move to another issue and talk about Governor Cuomo and
something cheerier, Joe.
Yes, a little bit. Maybe not for Governor Cuomo, not having a good day as far as public employee union endorsements go. The Public Employees Federation, the second state's second largest employee union, 55,000 members, I believe, has gone a step further and thrown its support behind Cuomo's primary opponent, Zephyr Teachout. They have had, it is, I think, safe to say that PEF has had a rather rocky relationship with the governor over the length of his administration. So, but while NYSUT just said, we're not going to endorse anyone, PEF takes a step and says, okay.
And I believe CSEA is also sort of sitting it out.
Yes.
And so I guess the news was somebody weighed in.
Right.
Yeah.
And you'd expect that the public employee unions, which have not been generally have not been happy with what the governor's policies have been, that extends from the teachers all the way to the state employees, you'd expect them to be sullen but not to be mutinous. PEF decides to be mutinous, and that's a real boost to teach out because in a Democratic primary where you're going to have a very small percentage of people turn out, boots on the ground really can make the difference. And, you know, PEF's a substantial political operation in addition to being a union.
But I think probably down the road, PEF will suffer some consequence for having and done so.
From the Cuomo administration?
Cuomo administration. Yeah, you betcha.
They're such a soft touch, those guys.
They could
may
possibly go wrong?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, the old line about, you know, forgive and forget. Okay, forgive that's and right. forget does not work in this administration.
Yes, they use different F words.
Yes, absolutely. Do you think that it could, is there any chance that that now that someone actually has taken the position, that that the other two unions would join in?
No, you know, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I assume. I mean, the political calculus for the most hard-boiled operatives, who run large organizations, is Cuomo's going to win. Why do I want to be on the wrong side of the guy come December? And they have contract negotiations coming up, so. Now, you know, again, unions are reflections of their membership. And the fact that PEF's membership apparently is unhappy enough that they've gone from sullen to mutinous, it may trigger explosions of outrage in some of the other public employee unions. But again, the hard-boiled political calculus is, do we want to be on the wrong side of somebody who looks like they're going to win?
Yeah.
We are going to take a break. We will come back. We have two or three more topics to discuss. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Blair Horner is here. Mary Alice Mulgard is here. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Horsleap Equestrian Tack Shop, Amenia, specializing in hunt country gifts, including new and consigned riding clothing, tack, horse treats, and horseware. Horsleap.com. Capital Wine at State and Lark in the heart of Albany, offering local and international wines, tastings Fridays 6 to 9, capitalwinestore.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond, 518-580-8080. And Double H Ranch, Lake Luzerne, providing outdoor Adirondack adventures for children with chronic and life-threatening illnesses, presenting Camp Challenge Ride or Run, September 6th, a serious fun camp, doublehranch.org.
Welcome back to our roundtable discussion, and as we wrap up this morning in our last 10 minutes or so, try to get to a couple of topics. Of course, earlier this week we talked about the death of Robin Williams. Yesterday it was announced Robin Williams was suffering from the early stages of Parkinson's disease, according to his widow, Susan Schneider. She said in a statement on Thursday, his suicide had provoked widespread speculation about his career, about his finances, and about his medical and about his mental condition. I found the story fascinating because, you know, we kind of weave a narrative that is based on the very limited facts that we have. So you have a hanging, you have a celebrity who at one point said that, you know, I'm going to take this serious because I need the money, and then you sort of put all that together and say, you know, there's addiction and depression and all of this stuff, and then the widow comes out and says, oh, by the way, we've been dealing with this for the last couple of months, and you throw that into the mix, and then the narrative quickly changes,
shifts away.
And to an issue of, and here was a man who, I know Michael J. Fox weighed in on this last night, but had been very active within raising money for Parkinson's disease and raising money for Michael J. Fox's foundation and organization. So it is it does change the story a little bit.
And the medical folks chimed in right away and said that early Parkinson's and depression are closely associated. So you know, now connecting dots a little bit more. And apparently the financial situation, that was a complete smokescreen because there apparently are no financial difficulties. There are houses everywhere you know, plenty of money in the accounts.
Well, and people would ask him, you know, why are you selling your house? And he said, well, hey, I need the money. Well, okay.
It's Robin Williams.
Right, it's comedian, right? You know,
I'm buying a house on Mars.
Right, yeah. You know, it's $58 million. Right. Okay.
Yeah, so I made a $7 million profit on whatever it was.
It's
the shtick.
Right.
But what has been reported is he did have problems with substance abuse.
Yes.
He had been being treated for depression recently. Parkinson's is something, you're right, that there's a close correlation with Parkinson's and depression. And so all of that stuff sort of comes together. But again, just the way I've sort of looked at it, I think it raises the question about his treatment. I mean, here's a guy who could clearly afford top shelf medical treatment. And I'm sort of interesting and sort of unsettling that here's a guy who probably is getting top-notch treatment and yet ends up committing suicide. He may not have wanted to have to deal with Parkinson's, which is no fun disease to have. On the other hand, maybe there was something with the treatment that went wrong. Maybe they weren't treating him properly in terms of how to deal with his depression that either came from Parkinson's or is exacerbated by Parkinson's.
And two quick notes. One is that his widow, Susan Schneider, did say that he was sober at the time. She believed, and also her statement saying the tremendous outpouring of affection and admiration. He was not yet ready to share this news publicly. And she said, it is our hope in the wake of Robin's tragic passing that others will find the strength to seek the care and support they need to treat whatever battles they are facing so they may feel less afraid. I know we're going on time, but can somebody explain to me what in the world is happening with Twitter and the cyberbullying of his daughter? Are you aware of the story?
Just marginally that people, you know, attacked her and, you know, kind of the idea that it was his fault, things, but that's really all I know.
And putting pictures that were supposedly of his dead body on and sending them to her. And I'm thinking, well, what... Now, finally, I guess Twitter has stepped in and has gone after some of the people for this and have shut down accounts and has frozen her account and so forth. But my God, you know, I don't get how that is allowed. Number one, I also don't understand, like even the impetus. You know, why anyone would do that? But I.
Well, there are people who will do those sorts of things no matter what.
But to such a large degree.
There are people who will make comments about anything. Sometimes they think they're being funny. Sometimes they think that anybody who's in the public eye is just automatically got a great big target painted on them. And Zelda, I believe, is the young woman's name.
Yes.
Right. You know, she just happens to have been Robin Williams' daughter, and she gets caught in the line of fire. But I don't understand how Twitter would be able to police this. And they're saying that now for those family members of celebrities who die in the future, that they're going to be more conscious of this. How are they going to do that? Are they going to now start monitoring the accounts of children of celebrities? You know, how are they going to prevent this? And I don't understand how the mechanism will work.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of the double-edged sword of the modern social media environment that we live in. I mean, on the one hand, it's a tremendous way for people to connect on lots of positive things and connect with people that they know. On the other hand, horrible things that people used to say just to each other and would be sort of contained within the walls of a room. And by the time they made it to a telephone, they thought twice about saying it to somebody else.
Count to 10.
Right. Now that it just goes out. And it makes for a coarser society. There's no doubt about it. And the sort of the hate and venom that you see is very troubling and doesn't and makes our society, I think, worse for it. That being said, when we talked before about Ferguson, a lot of the reaction that probably got the situation to calm down was because of the images that were coming out from social media, from people on the ground, where you see peaceful protesters with their hands raised in the air facing tear gas, machine guns, and that prompts a positive reaction. So it's the sort of the yin to the yang.
And finally, this morning we have a new baseball commissioner. There's a brand new baseball commissioner who was named yesterday, and apparently a fairly bloody battle at the at the Hyatt Regency in Baltimore, Maryland, where this came out. Bud Selig, of course, had announced that he was retiring, and
at the ripe old age of 80.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so Rob Manfred, a high-ranking executive in Major League Baseball for many years, was chosen as the sport's 10th commissioner, which is in and of itself pretty amazing. You're only the 10th. But so
100 years, right? They've had the 1919, I guess, was the first commissioner dealing with the Black Sox.
Right.
Yeah,
scandal,
Kennesaw,
right?
Mountain Landis.
So we're coming up. That's a great name.
I love it's that,
like,
yeah.
Like Zephyr Teachout, you know? So the 100th anniversary is coming up, 10 commissioners.
Yeah. So, no, you're absolutely, so he's confirmed as the sport's 10th commissioner after six rounds of voting by baseball's 30 owners who convened in a closed-door ballroom in downtown Baltimore until at least 23 of them, or more than three quarters, were in agreement. Eight of the 30 baseball owners voted for Tom Warner, an owner of the Boston Red Sox, in early balloting on Thursday. So the big question is, in the minute that we have left, is, you know, what do we know about this guy, and what does it mean for the game of baseball?
Well, I mean, clearly he was chosen by the majority of the owners because of he's related to the existing administration and the relatively. I mean, baseball's had a pretty good run the last few years. There haven't been any strikes. There, other than doping scandals, there really hasn't been anything that's affected the game, and people are making money. Owners want to make money, and if this new guy can keep the money rolling in, I think he'll be fine.
And it seems that he has a handle on the salary issues, free
right.
agency, the caps, those sorts of things that could disrupt a season. But that seems to be his kind of specialty.
Although the criticism of him was he's too cozy to the unions.
Right.
And so
yeah.
that was, again, the owners are a tough bunch. It's like sharks, you know, they're sort of eat at each other's throats as much as they are at anybody else's throats. And so it'd be interesting, we were talking about this off air, if he can engage the youngest generation of the X Games type of youngster to watch baseball, that's really what's going to matter. Because the owners are happy, the unions are happy, everybody's happy if the game is growing. And that probably means there's going to have to be some changes.
We're out of time. Mary Alice, Blair, thank you very much. Great to have you here, and we'll hear from you next week as well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.